Hi, it's Dave. Today, I am joined by David Gardner. He is the co-founder of The Motley Fool. You can find out more about them at fool.com. So I want to welcome David to the show. How are you doing?
One Dave to another, a delight to be with you. Thank you, Dave.
Awesome. I'm super excited. The Motley Fool needs no introduction. You guys have been going on for almost 30 years. You guys were pioneers in kind of the retail individual investor movement. Yeah, I'm excited. I interviewed your brother, Tom, about 6 months ago, and he was one of the funniest guys I've ever interviewed on my show.
Well, I'm not as funny as Tom, so let's keep our expectations really low. Tom is a wonderful storyteller and a great to be around. So yeah. Having spent a lifetime with the guy, I know that better than most.
I mean, you guys are co-founders. You guys lead the company together. I mean, do you guys have any tensions ever, or do you just work them out? Has it helped your guys', do you think, business to be together for this whole time?
Oh, it's definitely been a huge positive. Just the, you know, just default trust that you have and the knowledge of each other. Certainly we disagree on some things. We don't always pick the same stocks, and we wouldn't always do the same thing with our business. Tom's our CEO. Mm-hmm. So he's the one making the calls for the business. Mm-hmm. He's also my younger brother, which is kind of a fun dynamic, because most of the time it seems like it would be the older brother who might be the CEO, but I've never wanted to be CEO. I love picking stocks. I love business. I love being an entrepreneur and a co-founder, mm-hmm. but I'm not that interested in running a business myself. I'm delighted to have a great CEO doing that for us.
Yeah, I've got a ton of recommendations that people have given me to, you know, interview you. Tom mentioned, like, you're the growth, you know, kind of expert investor at Motley Fool. My friend Emmett Peppers, he continuously raves about you and Motley Fool. And this guy Muji, I interviewed a while back, he does SaaS, and he's also a big fan, a lifetime kind of Motley Fool user.
Yeah, Matt. Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, how have you kind of, like, managed kind of this continued just kind of, you know, outperforming the market, choosing great companies, building a community? Like, you know, at the core of it, was there a vision? Was there kind of this ambition to make something bigger? And kind of, you know, can you kind of take us through a little bit of that?
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, I would say, first of all, a lot of those things, the different aspects, managing a business, picking stocks, beating the market, mm-hmm. building a community, all of those things kind of work together. So while they look like disparate efforts, there's a lot of, well, Warren Buffett has a great line. You've probably heard this one before. I'm a better investor because I'm a businessman, and a better businessman because I'm an investor. And we have that at Fool HQ. We have that blown up in a big font on one of our conference rooms that we're eventually going to get back to sometime later this year, I think. We've been closed for more than a year now. But yeah, so that to me says a lot. I hope it says to everybody on your channel, Dave, and everybody who follows you and listens to you, I hope that they get that a lot of people disconnect their investing from their professional life. There's some people who are great professionals. They're like, I don't know the markets. I give it to my money guy. They say stuff like that. Then there are other people who are so obsessed with the market from one minute to the next, but they don't actually have a professional life necessarily, or they don't connect those things. I think those things work together, and it's actually a gyre that goes upwards. The better you get at one, the better that you get at another. And I feel as if we've gotten a lot better over our 28 years mm-hmm. at both of those. And certainly, you know, part of your question there was just, what was our vision at the outset? And our vision at the outset was to educate, to amuse, and to enrich. We knew that, and we continue to try to do that for 27 years, but this was pre-web. Yeah. This was back in the days when AOL was an online private service and was kind of the big dog for the 1990s. So we had a lot of ambition, and we recognized the medium and the power of the internet. And so many people were doubters, didn't think that people would ever give their credit cards over the internet. They didn't think e-commerce would work. These were conventional wisdoms at the time that we were kind of fighting. We were on CNBC explaining, I think the internet is for real. We were kind of those guys. So, and sometimes with our jester caps, which we enjoy wearing, I don't have mine on with me today, but I wear my cap quite a lot. But then people would also think that we were young guys, we were wearing jester caps, so they didn't necessarily think we wanted to be taken seriously. In some cases, they didn't take us seriously. So in some ways, which didn't bother us at all at the time, we're kind of true to our our uniforms and our purpose as a company. But so it was such a different time than today. And I know part of our conversation is going to be like, what is it like today to be picking stocks? And a lot of social media, there's a lot of following going on. And it's a very different environment than when we started The Fool.
Definitely. I mean, you bring up an interesting point of just like running a business is helping your investing, and your investing is probably helping running your business. I mean, I found the same thing. I've been an entrepreneur, you know, running my own business for over a decade. And one of the things I've learned is one of the most difficult things for new businesses, especially, is people don't care about you or your product. You know, it's like you have no exposure, you're unknown, and it's extremely difficult to get a presence, you know, to get people to care, you know, about your company. I mean, with Motley Fool, you've grown your company. I think it's almost 500 employees and contractors. Is that correct?
We're actually closer to 600 right now.
Wow.
Actually, that's okay. Just our employees. We have, I think, something like 800 contractors.
Oh my gosh,
so we have
more
contractors than employees. That's a big part of our business. The people who write articles on stocks every day is a big way that people find our business. When you talk about people not caring or knowing about businesses, you have to make a real effort to be relevant. So that's that's what a lot of people are working at. But yeah, that's where we are today.
Wow. So I mean, has kind of, you know, getting into the weeds of marketing and growth, has that given you a deeper appreciation for what it takes for like a growth company really to realize their dreams?
I think so. I mean, again, it's back to the Buffett line, but I won't repeat it again. I will say that my own style of investing, I call rule breaker investing. That's the name of my podcast. That's the name of the book that I wrote in the 1990s about my rule breaker principles. And so that's really kind of my brand and what I'm about. And, you know, the very nature of rule breaking is that we wanted to create a business that was a rule breaker. So I'm not just looking at your company or this one or that stock and asking, is that a rule breaker or not? And we can talk more about what I actually mean by that phrase. Some of your viewers will know, and many will not probably. So we can go deeper there. But I really wanted, and Tom has wanted, we wanted to create a company that has the same principles implicit in what we're doing as the stocks that we pick. So there's a lot of one-to-one there.
Most of the interview will be on rule breaking. We'll try to break the rules in analyzing rule breaking, actually.
Great, let's do it.
But I'm curious, 600 employees, what do you need them for? I mean, like, what's the kind of the breakdown of how these employees
Work well,
out?
I mean, a lot of them are in service to our members, and our membership is, I think we're at about 1.3 million people who are paying in some way, shape, or form, somewhere between $100 and maybe $5,000 as a business. So, yeah, we've got, I mean, about a third of us are techies, about a third of us are stock pickers, writers, and researchers, and then about a third of us are marketers, finance people, the guts that really runs a business. And so just broad strokes, that's kind of a look at what we're doing. And yes, we've been accelerating our growth through COVID. Because, and I know you're aware of this, the interest in the stock market is probably higher than it's ever been starting about a year ago. And so even though I wish this were all over yesterday, it certainly has greatly benefited and accelerated a lot of digital companies. Ours is one of them.
Did you see a big spike during last year in terms of just interest, visits, subscriptions, et cetera?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And we hadn't forecasted or planned for it.
Has it tapered down in recent months at all?
Yeah, a little bit. Okay. Yeah, certainly. Because I would say, I mean, part of it was that my rule breaker stocks, that type of company, aggressive growth oriented companies, had a huge peak, I would say, in February of this year. Mm-hmm. And then at least my portfolio dropped a fair amount from February to May of this year. And so I think some of the interest that people had, a lot of understandably shorter term reactions and sometimes thinkers probably weren't as psyched about their rule breaker stocks in May as they had been in February. But then again, we've seen some nice trickle back here in summer. But overall, we are at all-time highs, and the amount of interest that we see, even tapered down from February, is still well above what we were expecting as we planned our business a couple years ago.
All right, rule breaking. I want to get into this. I watched a bunch of your interviews on rule breaking investing. I'm kind of not satisfied with the depth of, you know, how people have tried to analyze this. I want to get down into the weeds a few levels deeper, I think, than most people have. When I look at it, I realize it's really different principles stuck together. I mean, a lot of different aspects. It's not just one thing you're talking about. And I think to do justice, we need to kind of attack each of these ideas or insights you have and right. really kind of look at them from different angles. I think one of the insights of maybe probably 10 or 15, it feels like, that bring all this together is you're picking individual stocks over passive index investing. You know, there's been a big movement with passive index investing. Buffett is a big fan. You know, it could beat most of the hedge funds out there. There's a big FIRE movement, independent kind of investing to retire early movement, who just, they don't want to deal with stock picking. You know, they just want to trust the market. Why are you a fan of stock picking? And can the average person really beat the S&P 500, you know, over a long period of time?
I'm a big fan of stock picking because, yes, the average person can, I think, should beat the S&P 500 over time. And almost everything that I've done over the last 28 years has tried to both demonstrate that to the world and also democratize it and make it possible, because at the heart of our business, we have people who are paying us to follow the advice that we give them. And we're beating the market, and they are too. That's why I think they're renewing their subscriptions. But to back it up a little bit, Dave, and I'm happy to go as deep as you want. I love this stuff. We're big fans of index investing. I mean, the Motley Fool, in a lot of ways, helped popularize that among more individual investors. Now, Vanguard probably didn't need our help, but it still got it in a lot of the books that we wrote and how we get people started investing, the 13 steps to investing foolishly, which are free on our website. All of these things point to the power of indexing, and I absolutely respect it. I'm grateful for it. Part of the power of it is that it's just very, very low cost, which is what Vanguard has been so brilliant at doing, bringing the basis points that they're getting paid down into just a handful. And so that is a remarkable revolution, and we're big Jack Bogle fans, so I want to make that really clear. And I think for people who want to go beyond that, who enjoy this topic, who have some energy or time or passion, I absolutely think you should be buying at least some of your investments directly through individual stocks. And you will be, I think if you follow the principles that we've laid out, you will be greatly rewarded for doing so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have any kind of expectations you can give? Let's say a person says, okay, I'm not sure. I'm an index fund guy, and I'm not sure about this individual stock picking. If I give it 5 to 10 hours a week, can I really substantially increase my returns? I mean, let's say average 9% per year, you know, stock market in the past, can I actually increase it to 11, 12, 13, 14%? Like, what is that, you know, extra motivation for me to want to put in the extra work, you know?
Right. Well, and again, let me say that if you're getting 9% annualized and you're a good saver and you're doing that as early as possible in life, your whole life, you're going to be very, very happy. And truly, a lot of us are not called to spend a ton of time doing investment research. We have other ways to we can add value to the world. And you know that. And as an entrepreneur, you can appreciate that as well. So, and if you do want to spend time buying stocks directly, I don't think it takes a ton of time. We have a lot of members of Motley Fool Stock Advisor, our largest service, who come in once a month, see what the new pick is by Tom, the new pick is by Dave, they buy it, they're done. And because we tend to recommend stocks to buy and we tend not to sell for long, long periods of time, And that means you don't have to spend a lot of time at this. And I'm really happy and I guess a little bit proud to say that the annualized returns of Motley Fool Stock Advisor since 2002, just following my approach, are something like 20.7% annualized. And that's something that anybody could have gotten, because from as we give out our stock picks, we're right then at the end of that day counting the stock and where it closed that day and scoring it going forward. Mm-hmm. So all of this is transparent. Anybody who's a member can see all my best, all my worst picks as well. Yeah. But yeah, 20% annualized is a huge, huge leap up over 9% annualized.
I mean, do you share your own personal portfolio in terms of its not just composition, but its actual annualized performance, let's say since 2002?
So, I mean, my own portfolio goes back to 1984 when I took it over from my dad. I've done very well. I haven't spent a lot of time calculating the individual return of it, but I own a lot of the same stocks that I recommend. There's a lot of one-to-one. And what I can say is I was persuaded enough by my own returns to, I guess, have the guts with my brother Tom to go on the internet as 20-somethings and say, hey, not only do we think academia is wrong, you can beat the market. It's not just a random walk down Wall Street. It can be for those who want to index, but we don't believe that. You can also you can do this too. It doesn't take a ton of time. We're English majors. We love the market. We were raised by a dad who taught us how to value line. So we're numbers guys too, but we're not rocking CFAs. We don't have MBAs. There's a lot of this is self-taught, and I think that a lot of people can also see themselves in that and recognize that they can do that too. So, Dave, to answer the question, in the end, the returns that are critical to me are the ones that our members get. And so the Rule Breakers service that I run and the Stock Advisor service that I run are very transparent with all the returns that we have. I also want to mention on my podcast, I pick stocks every 10 weeks in groups of five. I call them five stock samplers for 6 years now. So I've done that in a very, again, for free, and it's all transparent, and everybody can see exactly what I've done. So that's a really important thing for the Motley Fool, is to be transparent with people, show exactly how we're doing. Every employee at our company on their profile public lists the tickers of anything that they hold. That includes our receptionist or a brand new techie, as well as Tom Gardner or David Gardner. Mm-hmm. Those are all things that have been part of the Foolish culture since we started it. In 1993.
Got it. How has your research changed over the years? I would imagine in the beginning, you're doing everything, you know, in the weeds, reading all the 10Ks and the annual reports and the conference calls and all of that, looking through the financials. Fast forward to 2021, you and your brother are running this massive company. You have a lot of pressure. You have, you know, hundreds of employees, researchers for you. How has your research changed? Are you relying more on others on your team? And are there pros and cons to that approach versus back in the day when you were just in the weeds completely yourself?
Sure. Well, certainly it has evolved over time because, as you mentioned, when we started, we didn't have a staff. We were just picking the next stock ourselves as a couple of brothers on AOL and then the World Wide Web. So in recent years, I've had, for the Stock Advisor service and the Rule Breaker service, which are the Motley Fool's two biggest services, I've had a team of five people for each of them. And it's a little bit different, and we can geek out about this if you want, but I think it might be boring for the audience. But the basic guts of it are that for Stock Advisor, I come up with my five new thoughts, five new companies each month, and I give one to each of the analysts and say, could you please go off, do the research, and come back. Here's the template that I use, give them to research it for me so that I can read it and take it in a way that I like. And so we've been doing that for a couple of decades now, people who go off and do that. For Rule Breakers, a lot of the same style, but the actual makeup of it is that that's more of a team service, in that if Dave, you're on my team and I'm on my team, we're each picking our best ideas and the three other people, and then I look through the 5 or 10 ideas I have that month, and I'll say, we're going to go with Dave Lee this month. We're going to go with Dave's pick. So that's how Rule Breakers is a little bit different. It started after Stock Advisor, and I was like, I'm already doing a full-time job with Stock Advisor. So if I'm going to do Rule Breakers, I'm going to need to have a more of a team orientation. So that's a little bit of the difference. But overall, it's always been important to me to be bottom-line accountable for every single recommendation across both of those services. And in effect, we have 5 Best Buys now coming out for Stock Advisor members. So we're looking at our existing stable of 100 or so stocks and saying, which 5 do we like this month for new money 3+ years from now? We're always talking about long term. A lot of people think Best Buys now must be like, what's the one to buy this week? And then, no, it's it is the one to buy this week for 3 years from now. But anyway, so 5 for Rule Breakers, 5 for Stock Advisor. That's 10 picks. Then 2 new ones for Rule Breakers and 1 new one for Stock Advisor, 13 picks every single month for a couple of decades. And because this is relatively new, Dave, you may not know this, but I actually just transitioned away those operational stock picking responsibilities some weeks ago. So for me, I basically just planted a flag in the ground and said, 27 years, there you go. I've loved doing it. I've tried to teach all the way through and be transparent about it. And I'm going to do some new things. I'm not even sure what they are. I remain co-chairman of our company, and I'm very involved. My podcast keeps going every week. I love these. What you're doing, I love this kind of thing that you and I are enjoying together, talking about something we love in front of people who can learn from it, we hope. Okay. And so I'm going to keep doing that. But the actual stock research and stock picking, we just transitioned. So this is an interesting moment in time for you and me to be talking.
Got it. What is, like, of your 600 employees, you said?
Yeah.
And then you have 800 contractors. So of all the people you work with, are there a couple kind of just amazing researchers, just like you're just like, oh my gosh, like this person or this person, like, you know, maybe just a few in your hand, you could just say like, these guys are legendary in your mind. If you could think of those, you know, few legendary researchers, you know, in your company that just pull way more than their weight, they're just, you know, they're like gold. What is it about them that makes them so great of a researcher? Like, what is the defining characteristic, you know, that maybe they share, or maybe they're different, you know? I'm curious if you can give some insights.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's a great question. And I guess because I'm thinking of a bunch of different people, I'm just aware of how different they are from each other. So the pattern recognition that I'm going to give you isn't that there's a single thread that goes through all of them. It's appreciating each person's individual viewpoint. And so maybe the single thread is that each person has self-actualized themselves. They've become the best version of themselves, and they end up with their own unique viewpoint. So I think about Jeff Fisher, who's a longtime analyst for us here at The Motley Fool, and today helps run 1623 Capital, which is one of our sister companies, and it's a hedge fund. And so Jeff is somebody, we're happy to give him the keys to the kingdom in terms of his thinking about investing, because he is such a person of character, such an honest person with himself and others, such a learner. He's a learning machine, and he also doesn't take himself too seriously. And he's, even though it's a hedge fund, it's not like, we're not a hedge fund that trades in and out aggressively or anything like that. It's just an opportunity to give some of our members a hedge versus what I do, which is just give them new stocks all the time and be 100% invested in the market at all times. So Jeff Fisher is a great example of somebody who marches to the beat of his own drummer. And I can think of, I almost don't want to single people out because I love them all. They're all my children in a sense. And Tom and I have really grown a stable of people who understand, you know, a lot of the people, Joe Magier in Australia today, kind of in a lot of ways grew up with the Motley Fool. Mm-hmm. And today he runs, I would say maybe the most successful investing operation in the nation of Australia, Motley Fool Australia and Lake House Capital. You can take a look at Joe and his returns and what he's doing. And so I think that there's overlap that Joe and Jeff and Tom and I all look for growth. I actually try never to use the phrase growth stock. You won't hear me use that phrase other than when I just used it right there, because I don't like the value growth labeling. I think that's misleading and not the right way to think about things. But it's certainly true that we're all interested in innovation and what are the companies that are going to shape the future. And that's been at the heart of really everything I've done from day one, and a lot of other people around the Fool, I think, not everybody, but a lot of people take that general attitude.
If you were, I'll kind of come from a different angle here. If you were to restart, let's say Motley Fool from the very beginning with zero employees, just you and maybe your brother, Tom, you wanted to hire one researcher, you know, to carry you for the next 2 years.
Yeah.
What kind of person would you be looking for? Like, what would be that characteristic? Like, yes, this is the person I want. Right?
That's a great question. I like the reframing, and I hope I was not off the rails with that previous answer. Yeah. But I think what I would do is I would find somebody who complements me, somebody who has strengths where I have weaknesses. So a quick example for me, and Tom might say the same thing, but I'll just speak for myself here. I'm more of a big picture person and more of a pattern recognition person. And the rule breaker investing principles that I've kind of enumerated, I've realized and then enumerated and communicated over time, are more bigger picture ways of looking at things. So what I would be looking for that employee number one would be somebody who loves to go knee deep into the 10-Ks, Qs, and filings, somebody who has deep industry knowledge for industries that matter to me or that seem interesting to me. Part of the problem, though, is that all industries seem interesting to me, and I'm not just focused on electric cars. Or as much as I love Tesla, and I'm glad that we've had a recommendation in since November of 2012, I think. But anyway, so it's great to know a lot about one thing, but we also really do look for generalists. So the people I've already mentioned, Jeff and Joe, Tom and Dave, and a lot of others, we tend to be a mile wide and an inch deep. Mm-hmm. The strength of that is you can make connections other people don't, because they're so siloed in their niche that they're just thinking about crypto. Yeah. We try to learn a little bit about everything and then make connections that people might not otherwise make. So anyway, since I'm already that way, I'd be looking for somebody who can really go deep.
Got it. I noticed, like, I mean, this is like taking more of a step back philosophically a bit. It feels like part of your rule breaker or your whole approach tends to be a bit kind of rebellious, a little bit non-traditional. You're not afraid to do the opposite role. Like if people are, you know, buying low, selling high, you're like, well, what's the opposite? You know, buy high, yeah. hold forever or something, you know,
That's
kind of
a
crazy, you know, yeah. approach or thinking to it. Have you always been like that? Kind of this non-traditional, kind of more out of the box, look at it from another angle that, you know, other people might not be thinking about.
I have been. And it's just my nature, and it's a strength and a weakness. I'm devil's advocate. If somebody goes really strong to the hoop, let's say with a political belief that I might even generally kind of favor myself, if they're too strong, I can't not be. I'm a guy who starts saying, well, what about the other side or the other people? So I've always admired people who can look at conventional wisdom mm-hmm. and say, there's a different way. And, you know, a lot of conventional wisdom exists because it's true. And a lot of the things that we appreciate from the Charlie Mungers of this world, who just kind of put it out there and we're like, that is horse sense. That is so right. And I wish people heard that or could really inculcate that in their minds and their actions. But especially when I found things that everyone believes that are not true, that's where our greatest value add is as entrepreneurs or thinkers, investors, et cetera. So, Dave, absolutely. I have tried to be subversive. I've tried to invert the truths that a lot of people have been handed down. A lot of people think you should never buy individual stocks. I mean, how about that? That's one of the biggest conventional wisdoms that I think is wrongheaded of our time. And the Motley Fool's been making hay about that for about 28 years and counting. And I don't even think we're winning the battle right now. I think a ton of the world is doing what I call big, dumb money, which is what I think indexing does. It doesn't draw distinctions between excellent enterprises and mediocre ones. It just sloshes big, dumb money everywhere. It actually makes the job easier, in my mind, for stock pickers when everybody else doesn't care. They just want to get the gentleman's C of index fund investing. So yeah, I love to break the rules. That's where value is created.
You mentioned how, you know, sometimes you see the other side very clearly. Do you think you do, I mean, just looking back at your, you know, your life, is that something that, like kind of seeing both sides of the story? I think, I mean, one thing is you see both sides of the story, but then most people will just side with one automatically or, you know, like quickly. But there are some cases where some people seem to be able to hold both sides together at the same time and without having to like have a bias or, you know, necessarily make a quick conclusion. Do you find yourself doing that, kind of able to hold both sides?
That's exactly what I try to do. And, you know, I think I just kind of do it naturally. I'm not trying to make myself sound like a swami about this. I'm sure a lot of people do this better than I do. But I think F. Scott Fitzgerald has a line, something to the effect of the ability to hold two contrary opinions in the mind at once is genius. I like that. I like that line and that concept. And yeah, I talk about this a lot. I'll give a quick example. So there are wise sayings, and I'm going to give one right now. Look before you leap. Now, that's a wise saying. A lot of us can recognize that. Somebody once put their arm around us. They said, you know, Dave, look before you leap, right? And you're like, yeah, you're right. I should have looked before I leapt, and I wish I had. And yet, here's the problem. The exact opposite of that wise saying is also a wise saying. Here it is. He who hesitates is lost. Now, we can also go back in life. Somebody put their arm around us. Say, you know, Dave, he who hesitates is lost. You had one shot there. And you weren't quick enough, or you didn't recognize it, and you're poorer today for it. And we can all say yes and yes. So look before you leap, but he who hesitates is lost. Holding both of those ideas in your mind and then knowing when to apply which one is, to me, wisdom. Wisdom with a capital W, something that the capital F, fool in me, aspires to. And there are lots of examples of that, Dave. And so to me, each of those is a tool. It's a thought tool. And when you get that thought, he who hesitates is lost, somebody teaches it to you, or you learn it from the hard knocks of experience, you just drop that into your toolbox. And a lot of people just have like a few tools. They're like the he who hesitates is lost guy. They're always going for something new because they never want to miss it. And you can actually be pretty awesome in life if you take one of those wise phrases I just gave you and if you make it yours. But I think an even better life is to fill up your toolbox with as many thought tools as possible and then know when to pull out the wrench or the screwdriver or the hammer. That's what I'm trying to do. And that's what I try to teach people through my podcast and a lot of my work. So thank you for asking that, because that's very important to me.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, what you're talking about is like, you know, holding these seemingly opposing ideas, right? But holding them together. I talk about sometimes kind of two sides of the same river. They might not kind of seem like they can match. And in our heads, maybe they're complete opposite, but like there's a respect for, you know, both views.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I echo a lot of your thoughts. Like this comes naturally for me and I use it every day. And it's kind of like this thing I always rely back to, you know, like when I'm evaluating something, I'm thinking about something, I have this, a little bit of this detachment where I'm able to kind of put myself a little bit out of it and see the different angles more clearly. And I've never really like been exposed to how to learn that though. Like, is there a systematic way or is there, like, have you seen like people being able to pick up that skill or is that something that is like formed early on? What's your take?
I don't know enough about it because in this case, I'm just a practitioner. I'm not an academic researcher or somebody who's studied this in others. So it's kind of comes naturally to me too, Dave. So you and I share that. I don't know. What is your take? Do you think it's, I mean, I certainly talk about it a lot. So people just heard you and I rock that. So somebody might've just switched on or had his eyes open, but there is a difference between hearing something and then actually being able to practice it.
Yeah.
So I don't want to make that assumption every time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to spend the whole interview because I have tons, but I think this is fascinating to me because I don't see many people talking about this, but one of the ideas, as I kind of look back, I have more now to look back in my life. I kind of feel like there's this recognition or this deep sense that there is something true above the thing I'm looking at. Meaning like I'm looking at something right now. Everyone thinks that it's only this and only that. And that is the ultimate truth, right? You have to choose. But then for me, it's like, I'm like so aware that no, there's something a higher level above that. Like yeah. Overarching, that's even more true. And that
I agree.
And that I have a sense of humility when I look at these two opposing views where I'm like, you know, I don't think this is the complete picture here. That's why partly I could hold both of them and see the pros and cons of both. Does that resonate with you at all or is
yes,
there something else?
Yes, I'm going to give you one of my favorite lines in a minute. But I mean, what we've already done in our conversation together is we've said index investing is good. And by the way, buy individual stocks. I mean, that sounds like we're talking on both sides of our mouth. Both are true. Both are basically tools. Some people may just use one and not the other, but I see a relevance for both. And even though I grew up only ever thinking about stocks, we were raised by a dad who just owned a stock portfolio. He wasn't a professional. He was just an investor himself. I didn't even know what funds were practically until my early 20s. It wasn't even clear. Whereas most people, it's this huge leap to go from mutual funds, which feel safe and everybody says are good, or index funds at least, to the idea that they would actually buy stock directly feels like a leap. So we've already done what we're talking about. We've already shared seemingly opposite thoughts, incorporated both of them into our thinking and our actions and our advice. One of my favorite lines I'm going to give you here, because if you haven't heard it, I think you're going to like it. The greater the island of knowledge, the longer the coastline of mystery. And if you're a learning machine, which is what I think we as humans need to be to evolve and adapt and thrive in the world in which we live today, then you recognize that there is always something more. The more you learn about something, the more you start to realize, wow, there's even more there that I didn't even think of before. So that's true of both abstract frameworks, like we've been rocking with my he who hesitates is lost, look before you leap, right? But it's also true of any industry, any technology. Even if you feel like you know everything you could possibly know about the semiconductor industry, you start going, well, but how are these things actually used in new and interesting ways? And it starts branching out into all kinds of other use cases that you weren't even aware of before you got there. So I think it's really helpful to have intellectual curiosity at your heart. And I certainly do. I think you do. I bet a lot of people watching us do. And that's why they are fascinated by investing, as I am.
Yeah, definitely. I'm curious. I was reading something that you have kids. I'm not sure their ages, but what did you teach them about investing? Like, what was the core crux, like the lesson you wanted to get across to your kids?
So I had the great fortune of having a dad who not just taught Tom and me out of Value Line, sort of the hardcore numbers of businesses as we were teenagers, but who started portfolios for us at birth. And so at age zero, unbeknownst to me, understandably, Dad started investing. And at age 18, he turned that over to me. And he said to me and then to Tom and our sister, here you go. This is all you're ever getting from me. Anything that I have left when I die, unfortunately, he hasn't yet, will go to your kids. So don't screw up. And I mean, he's a wonderful dad, a loving guy, somebody who works really hard, who loves the markets more than anything, even though he was a lawyer by trade. I did that for my kids. That's square one, I think. The earlier you get any child invested, the better. They're not going to understand a darn thing at age zero or even age six. But by age 12, 14, 16, I think you're talking with your kids, as I did, and mine are all now in their mid-20s. You're talking about the world, this business. Why is Chick-fil-A, why are there always lines around the door at that place and they're not over the other place in town? Or what about your, what is that new app on your iPhone, et cetera? Almost any interesting conversation about culture, as an investor, you start to realize there's a public company usually behind that product or service. I think that's a minority viewpoint. I think most people go through life and they don't even think about they could be a part owner of the company that makes that product or service that they like. Many people sadly don't get that until too late in life when they can't compound their returns as well. So that's a big part of our parenting with our kids, was just investing for them, turning over their portfolios to them, but also having them actively think about what wins in the world and why.
Mm-hmm. Did you also say to your kids at 18 that they're not going to get anything else from you?
I didn't actually say that. And I had one tweak, which is I gave it to them at 21 mm-hmm. instead of 18. I felt a little distracted during college by that. It took away a little of my ambition. It wasn't so much, by the way, that I wasn't going to be getting a job one day, but it was enough that it gave me a measure of financial independence relative to my peers. The good news was, even though it was sort of hard to think about what life meant at that point, everyone else is rushing out to get their first job and they're ambitious, and all of a sudden I'm like, I don't necessarily have to do that. But that ended up being the seed capital that started the Motley Fool. And our dad, if he hadn't taught us a love of the stock market, the fool would never have existed. So that's really where it started. But Dave, I would say kids, I wanted to give them more time to keep growing. Also, I gave myself 3 more years to compound their portfolios, which was helpful too. But yeah, yeah. 21 has been the magical number for us.
Definitely. You're going almost on 3 decades of the Motley Fool, and you've seen a lot of changes. You've seen the internet, you know, pop up with AOL and Yahoo, and you've seen YouTube pop up and Twitter, TikTok, all this stuff. How is social media and where things are headed? How is that changing investing? Is it democratizing it more? Is it making it more difficult or easier to get returns? Like, are there different set of challenges? Like, and yeah, how do you kind of assess the situation?
It's a great question. I don't think there's an easy, quick answer to that question. And I'm not going to give a really long, hard to understand answer either. We can go deeper here if you want. I mean, I would say net, it's really a positive. I mean, even from the first days of The Fool, and you're right, it was a different time back then. But we were like, wow, you know, rather than have to buy the S&P 500 chart guide to see on paper sent quarterly the graph of where that stock has been the last 2 years, it's now free. And it updates itself every minute, and you can go back historically. And so it was so obvious at earliest days that this was going to be a huge boon for individual investors like us. And that's what I still am today. I'm not a money manager myself. I'm basically just like one of our members. I'm an individual investor, a mom and pop type, and that's who I serve and talk to most of all. But wow, what an incredible benefit the internet net has been for me as an investor, I think for all of us. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to learn from others via social media is priceless. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, they could only have dreamed that we have anything like we do, the access to information that we have today, that we take for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like growing up in junior high school, we did a stock market contest where we had to look at the daily newspaper every day to calculate our stock prices. And
me
we had
too.
No other information, no news. You
exactly.
Just go completely off of that.
I did that in fifth grade, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Actually,
not everybody does, by the way. Some people have no exposure to the stock market in their schooling. But yeah, great example.
But like fast forward to today, you can get almost any information on any company, any stock. How do you view the other side of kind of this hyper-connected world where people are, it seems like reacting to everything. Everything is like short-term thinking. They want to see the gains this week. They want the next big GameStop or, you know, or AMC or something. And it seems like a very herdish kind of follow mentality. I mean, do you think, with the internet and social media, where is this headed? Do you think it's going to rebound back to something, you know?
It's a fun topic. And this is almost the sort of thing we could have this conversation every 3 months and we'd be saying different things as we go because it's all evolving. I mean, I would just broaden it briefly, Dave, and I would say, forget about investing. What about just social media, period? I mean, investing is just one component, a niche of that. But I mean, what's happening is there is a lot of bandwagoning going on. And there's some cancel culture that gets driven by, there are witch hunts on the internet. There's a lot of unpleasantness and there's so much goodness. And that's what I tend to focus on, the benefits of being connected as we are today. You and I really only have this opportunity to reach anybody hearing us because of the internet. And social media has helped that in a lot of ways. So similarly, for investing then, I would say that there is, if you are somebody who is, I would say, a long-term thinker and player, you can make great use of this medium. And I think a lot of people have greatly accelerated their learning. They didn't need to go get an MBA. They didn't need to become a chartered certified financial analyst. They actually could just learn it all, as I did, from others using this medium. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who don't make good choices, don't follow good thoughts, and I think probably can be ruined by what they read, not just in investing, but other aspects of the internet as well. There's a lot of fake news out there, people who are just fundamentally, I guess they're so short-term focused on their one stock that they really want to make them a lot of money that I think they don't make good decisions because they're not diversified and they're not really playing the game the right way. So like almost any powerful tool, it can be used for good or for ill. We're all about, for our members anyway, and our followers of The Motley Fool, we're trying to make it good for them, the best we can make it.
Yeah. I mean, talking about kind of the internet connectedness, also kind of, you know, people, let's say with crypto, you know, there seems to be a natural dynamic of people wanting to pump their stock, their crypto, right, to see appreciation. And it's like this hyper, you know, environment there. What are your thoughts on crypto? Are you guys generally bullish, skeptical, or you guys have a different idea?
Well, first of all, there is no one viewpoint at The Motley Fool, and that's really the motley of The Motley Fool. I'm the one who pulled our name, and I pulled it from Shakespeare. And at the time, I wasn't thinking of this, but we've grown into this and realized it's such a beautiful word because it speaks to the power of diversity. And you know, motley was the garment worn by jesters of yore, the ragtag quilt, colorful garment that they would, and that's what we need more of in this world. Inclusion is motley. We need more inclusion in this world. We're trying to make everybody feel included by the markets and by our financial system. And that's a big thing that I'm now working on for the Motley Fool Foundation, which is part of the reason I transitioned my role. But anyway, so I think that it's really important for us to recognize that there are great benefits that come from having as many different friends with as many different ideas as you can manage. But I do, with crypto, that's one of those things that I don't feel a strong sense of for or against. And it does feel like sometimes people talk about the political world this way. There's a lot of binary, yes or no, in or out. I guess I'm too nuanced a person. I bet you are too. There are a lot of grays. Not everything is black or white. And so for me, I don't have that much interest in crypto. It's not something that I'm fired up about. But I would be fired up about a world where there was a currency that was global and universal and that couldn't be inflated by sovereign governments. And so part of that dream or possibility, I think, is very attractive for the world. I like that. At this point, it would probably be Bitcoin or nothing else because Bitcoin has so much of the brand following and built-in base. So a lot of the rising cryptos that people, I think, want to get excited about look like penny stocks to me that people want to get excited about. And sometimes it's because somebody's hyping it up to try to make money off of everybody else. I'm not that cynical to say that's always the case, but that's why I really don't spend a lot of time in that area. I do admire Aaron Bush at our company, another great investor, is somebody who's very well steeped in that and that understanding. So that's part of our motley. We don't expect There are no perfect people, Dave Lee, only perfect teams. And so we've tried to have people who with a lot of different viewpoints and deep knowledge mm-hmm. across many things that I just would lack myself.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
What about you on crypto?
Yeah, I mean, going back to this whole two opposing ideas, right? Let's say on one hand, like I actually see immense potential with certain, you know, crypto, like with blockchain technologies, with the concept of decentralized, you know, social networks or even economies, like the whole metaverse going online, but going decentralized using crypto. And I think the potential is mind-boggling and I'm excited about that. On the flip side, I do see these certain dynamics that, like, for example, people, you know, the criticism, you know, crypto gets a lot is kind of this greater fool's theory, right? It's always looking for the next person to buy it at a higher price and higher price. And a lot of it is this demand-driven thing where it's almost inherent inside the framework of the crypto asset where people need to have more demand, or it needs to have more demand in order for the price to go up. You know, once demand is like exhausted, then what's going to happen? So there seems to be like definitely these two sides, and most people just, you know, go to one side, you know, they go hype or they go total criticism. For me, you know, I hold probably less than 1% in crypto, but, and I see the future, the potential, but I also have this kind of this the other side where I'm like, I want to be invested also in things that I'm proud of too, that are like, and some crypto do have that vision, but, I'm always weighing those things on both sides. So, I mean, that said, like I made an investment in crypto last week, you know, in a game that's just like people are talking about, but it's something that I'm constantly looking at with an open mind, you know, and examining both sides.
And I'm the same way. I really think the open mind is the key. And that's, again, not just true of investing. It's mm-hmm. very true of life. So you'll never hear me decry crypto or call anything a hype wagon because you have to respect it and you have to be interested in it. And I've seen enough things surprise us. A lot of people thought an electric car could never really work. And then, it has. And it's become one of the most successful companies of our time. So I've seen caterpillars become butterflies many times in the past. So I'm always going to be interested in the caterpillar, even if I decide not to invest in that caterpillar or it's just not for me.
Definitely. So a couple like fascinating stuff is like you've been talking about is kind of, you know, these two sides, but you also talk about this idea of you're generalist or you're interested in so many different areas. I'm curious if this connects at all to your priority or the importance you place on founders and the people in the company, meaning for a lot of Wall Street or a lot of purely financial quantitative people, it's like all about the numbers, right? But to actually factor in the founders themselves, I mean, this is a different kind of framework. And one of my friends, Emmett Peppers, he's asked a question. And he's wanted me to ask you for a while, actually, for probably over a year. He's like, if you ever get David Gardner on, please ask him this. And the question is on founders. And he's like, first he's saying, like, who do you see as up-and-coming founder CEOs? But then he wants to know, what is your process in evaluating founders? What qualities are you looking for specifically? And he kind of looks at this as one of your guys' kind of secret advantages or viewpoints, you know, that you actually factor into your decisions, founders. But yeah, how do you do it? What are you looking for exactly?
Well, and let me say that I think that, first of all, thank you, Emmett. Thank you for that interest. And Dave, it's a great question. I'm going to give you my four attributes that I look for in great leaders. Usually they're founders. I also don't want to ever be the guy who overrates founders. I think in particular, Tom, my brother Tom, really focuses on founders, founder-led. That's like a big phrase for him. I like that. I recognize that most of my great stocks that I've held for, I've held Netflix since 2004, are usually founder-led companies. Elon Musk. I mean, the list goes on of just great stock picks. And yet, I've got some great stock picks like Intuitive Surgical that is not particularly founder-led or founder-driven. So for me, it's not something that I start with and screen for or filter down from. I'm actually much more a bottoms-up person who flips up stones, looks what's underneath. I'm like, that looks interesting. And often some of the best ones are founder-led. So with that said, Dave and Amit, I would say there are four things that come to mind when I'm looking for a great leader of a public company. One is, and it's my Yoda. We're gonna rock an acronym here, a mnemonic. It's the Yoda school of leadership I'm about to give you. So, of course, four letters. Youthful owner delivers ambitious. Youthful owner delivers ambitious. A quick word about each of those. In general, my observations of some of what we've seen over decades now is that when great new companies start, it's often that person who dropped out of college and got started. It is Bill Gates. It is Steve Jobs. It is people who are young. Mark Zuckerberg. And I see the same thing in sports, right? When you see Tiger Woods crushing it as a college golfer or as a little kid, big surprise that he ends up being one of the great golfers, not just of our time, but of all time. So I think greatness usually is evident at earlier points than most people would respect or recognize. And it's easy to see with athletes, but people really doubt the young entrepreneurs. And when we were in our 20s, we felt very doubted. Now, we were wearing full caps and people probably thought we were silly. Some of them did. But I really respect youthfulness. I think that is a great attribute to have and to look for. Second, owner. Yeah, it's kind of what you're saying. We want that person, that founder, to own more shares than I do. And I really like it when they own a huge number of shares, because if I found somebody who's a visionary and youthful and they own a lot of stock, that's a great sign. It means they have the same alignment with me and motivations that I have to grow something great over the long term. The third one was delivers. I'm all about your bond is your word. And, you know, what do you say you're going to do next year? Great. You beat that and you beat it again and again and again. I love under promise, over deliver. Who doesn't? And what the opposite of that, I guess, are people who have an amazing idea and sometimes they get public market capital or at least private market capital, but they don't necessarily deliver on it. And that's usually a really bad sign for me. So now we found youthful people who own a lot of stock and deliver. And the last letter A is for ambitious. And I think that we have more opportunity today to hear from CEOs. We've got YouTube. We've got CNBC. We've got all of the publications. We have the company's own websites. We have an unbelievable way to tap into who are the people, get to know them, LinkedIn, understand their backgrounds. We really should be pinching ourselves the amount of access that we have to really figure out the character of the people we're investing in. And I love ambition. Ambition can cut both ways and overdone, right? Like some of those toolbox things we were talking about earlier, the opposite can be good or bad. You can be too ambitious and you can be not ambitious enough. But right there, Aristotle's golden mean, ambitious. I love to see that, right? People who are really competitive and they want to win. They want to win for themselves and for all of us because we're owning their stock along with them. So those are, not trying to be too trite here, but the Yoda acronym can give somebody who wouldn't have thought about this before a framework.
Got it. What do you think about strategy? Because I notice a lot of, you know, CEOs or founders, some of them actually, like, for example, take Zuckerberg with his whole, you know, campus by campus beachhead, right, strategy, or Elon Musk's, you know, top-down niche roadster Model S, or take LinkedIn, or so many of these founders, they oftentimes have some type of different angle of looking at strategy, like how to attack the market, even how they view their own products. You know, sometimes, you know, I look at a founder and sometimes they don't have high enough standards. They think they can attack the market with an average so-so product. Or I'm like, you know, most of the greatest founders I've seen have had super high standards of what type of experience or product, right, that they know that they need to have to even have a chance in the market, right? Does strategy, you know, play a part in the type of founders and CEOs that you're evaluating and looking for?
I mean, I would say vision first and foremost. And often strategy is part of someone's vision. But their vision is, let's go right back to rule breaking. I love the people who look at conventional wisdom, how the world's set up, and say, I'm going to do it differently. Jack Dorsey, 140 characters. It sounded so silly when I first heard about it, explained to me by one of our Motley Fool techies more than 10 years ago. So you're limited to just 140 characters and you're tweeting out what you're eating right now? What is going on there? Seems so silly. Or how about Reed Hastings? why would I mail back and forth DVDs when I can just drop it off at the Blockbuster on my corner? And Blockbuster's so much bigger than Netflix. Why would that work? So those guys and a lot of others are rule breakers. They basically looked at how the world was set up. And if you play the rules by, if you play the game by those rules, your Goliath is going to win. Mm-hmm. The world is set up by rule makers. And Goliath, just to use a quick example, is a rule maker. And if you try to fight Goliath's strength on strength, you will lose. The world is set up for Goliath to win. That's why, here we are, as fellow Daves, that's why David's approach to beating Goliath was completely unexpected and the way to win. Was that strategy? Was that vision? Some mix of those things, maybe a third thing. But one thing is clear, he was breaking the rules. And so it's the breaking the rules part of it that really means a lot to me. I would say a lot of people say, I love it when people are critics of their own industries. You know, they come in and say, you know, why? I mean, wow. John Legere, you think about T-Mobile. He basically called AT&T and Sprint or whatever dumb and dumber. And he came in and he just totally flipped that industry. He created sex appeal. He made it pink. He made it fun. He was so customer-centric in his focus. And was that strategy? Yes, probably. It was more than that, though. It was an intent to break the rules and subvert the traditional practices of his own industry, which is what Reed Hastings did as well by saying, you know what? We're actually going to the real innovation for Netflix was that it changed the business model. It actually said we're subscription. Before it was transactions with late fees, and it flipped to it wasn't so much a net story as it was a change of business model story. That takes vision. That is strategy. So these things are very tough. But one thing underlies all of these. There are people who are breaking the rules. By the way, rule breaking can be bad. I don't like criminals. Those kinds of rule breakers I don't like. But I love the Davids, and here we are, two Daves, when they look at Goliath, how the world's set up, and they say, those are the rule makers. Let's compete by being rule breakers. And those are the enterprises that I backed.
Mm-hmm. You talk about kind of this whole thing of people who are critical of their industry. And I'm curious, do you find that yourself? Like, does that resonate with yourself? Like
totally.
when you're looking at, I don't know, can you give some examples? Like one example for me is anytime I walk into a restaurant or into a business, I evaluate how the business is doing right off the bat. I go, they can do this is better, or they're doing this is great. Or I'm curious, how does that realize in your own life? Are you, you know, that type of critical, you know, viewpoint?
Yeah, I would say that I try to do it first and foremost for my own company. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're bad at a lot. We can improve a lot of the things that we're doing. Good news is we're doing well. And my brother is doing a wonderful job as our CEO now in his, I think, his 14th year of our 28 years. But, I mean, start by being self-critical. I all the time on my podcast talk about my losing stocks and my losers. I think you have to lose to win in this world in a lot of important ways. That's a big theme for me. So I think it starts with being, you know, I love Robert Frost's line. It was one of his poems, but it's the line on his gravestone. And here it is. I had a lover's quarrel with the world. So I think we should have lover's quarrel with our own industries. I think we should have lover's quarrels with our own companies. I think we can improve our companies by loving it first and foremost, but also thinking, hey, could we do this better? And I think we should do the same thing for ourselves, of course, looking ourselves in the mirror. Have a lover's quarrel with you yesterday. I hope you love yourself. That's really important, even to love others. You have to start by loving yourself. But I think it's also helpful to have a quarrel and think, you know, there's a way to do this better. Why couldn't I do this better? So so I love that mentality. I love the Robert Frost line. And I think that's – I love those CEOs and those founders. They're not all founders, those CEOs who think that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder if you're kind of drawn to those CEOs, you know, because we share some of those values or, you know, those perspectives.
That's probably
yourselves.
True. There's probably some unconscious bias there that may be working for or against me.
Exactly.
Not sure. But yeah, I think that's probably true.
You know, throughout our chat so far, we've, you know, one of the recurring themes is kind of rule breaking, thinking outside the box, you know, doing things different, a little bit critical, et cetera. I want to ask you this question. With Motley Fool and kind of giving a stock pick recommendation, and you saying in the beginning, if people just followed our stock picks, right, they would outperform the market. It sounds a bit kind of the traditional type of, you know, don't take things in your own hands, don't research your own hands, just follow someone else's, you know, recommendation or picks. It's kind of like more of the culture of stock picking, you know, oh, pick this stock, do this, this is going to go up, right? And so, I mean, it could feel like to some, like, you know, it's similar in that sense. You're saying, you know, pick this, rather than learning the basic critical thinking skills yourself, right? And doing your own research and finding the real opportunities yourself. Like, is there any tension with that? Or do you feel like, is that just hard, too hard to do? It just takes too long for most people? Or is it just a stepping stone to first get, you know, the stock picks and then eventually learn how to think more critically? Yeah. What's your take?
Well, you know, I do feel like we've learned some things over 28 years. So we are the do-it-yourself types ourselves, and do-it-yourself investors, mom and pop, armchair investors, individual investors. We love to do that. And I would say of the membership, our customer base today, I would say maybe 1 in 3 of our members is that way. But if you want to grow a business that you're trying to help as many people as possible, the purpose of the Motley Fool is to make the world smarter, happier, and richer. And if you start doing that, you start going, okay, so what about the 2/3 of all the people out there that if they could just come in once a month, hit a button, and their investing is done, that's exactly what they would do. And I can relate to that because I love convenience in other things outside my own professional work. I love one button Keurig coffee. That's a lot. I know some people, maybe 1 in 3, just to stick with my math here, maybe 1 in 3 enjoy the process of brewing it themselves, the beans and all the rest. But I think a lot of us just want convenience. I think businesses that deliver convenience are usually the heroes. I think Apple delivers a convenient way to access higher technology relative to figuring out your Android operating system or your other devices. And I love them all. They're all great companies, but Apple has simplified, right? So the simplifiers, the democratizers, those are powerful businesses. I think we're a small example of that, Dave, because while I'm all about my 1 in 3 who want to do it themselves, and they're the ones who listen to my podcast probably every week, right? Because, and they're the ones watching us right now. We're heavily over-indexed right now to people who really love this stuff and want to learn. Turns out, in my experience anyway, 28 years of it, the majority of the world is not that way.
Exactly.
They want to do something else than this. Uh-huh. They want this to work, but we, as fools, we do our best to give them that one button convenience. Sure, come in once a month and just find out what the new pick is and buy it. And by the way, you're holding it for at least 3 years. It's not about how it does today or this week. It's all about playing the game the way most people in the markets never do. Because even long-term thinkers in the markets, in my experience, think about 1 year ahead. I think the market itself is about 6 months ahead. When people say an efficient market, I generally agree with them. I think the market, I respect the market very much. I'm not somebody who sits there in judgment and thinks people are idiots with how stocks are being priced or where the market is today. I think it's our best human understanding, because obviously, if you disagree with it, right away you could buy or sell and move the market. So it's our golden mean of where it is, but it's so short term. It probably only looks about 2 quarters ahead, because so much institutional money is such hot money that moves. And so we can totally win the game by playing it differently than Goliath. And that's why, among other things, Tom and I have tried to teach the world to think at a minimum 3+ years from now, 3 years at a minimum from now, but preferably 3 decades. Yes, don't buy low, sell high. Buy high and try not to sell.
Yeah. I mean, I love that because, you know, I talk about a lot about having to find your own edge in investing. And a lot of the pushback I get from people is like, oh, that's impossible. You can never have an edge to investing, you know, like all the information out there. But as you're talking about, like, so much of the institutional world is so focused on the short term, the next 6 months, you know, the long-term thinkers are 12 months out or something, you know, in Wall Street. And to evaluate it differently, just to have a different time frame, you look at things very differently, different companies, different approaches, et cetera. I'm curious, in your evaluation, we've got a question here from Arsalan on Twitter. He says, how much do you look at macro conditions in your investing? If you have this 3-year timeline, does it matter if, you know, like what the economy is doing right now, or is it just less important than maybe what some other, you know, investing approaches would have?
So here comes another quick answer out both sides of my mouth. It's a yes and answer. So yes, I do care about the markets in the near term, and I do care about macro. Just like, yes, I'm a baseball fan, and I follow every game. I'm interested in today's game and what happened, and I think we can learn something from today's game, whatever happened. And it's just today and one game. And so for me, where I come down on that, and thank you for the question, Arsalan, I spend very little time thinking about macro. Here's why. Because even though I think it's cool and fun, and I think it's we should be intellectually curious about it, I, from early days, made a lifetime commitment to the stock market, to investing. I'm 55. I've been invested for 37 years, doing it myself, and I'm going to be doing it, I hope, at least 37 years more. And it's worked absolutely wonderfully because I'm playing the game differently than the vast majority of people playing that game. And so I know the market's going to crash at some point. It has already. A number of times since the Motley Fool has been in business, we've watched it crash. It'll happen again and again in future. And stocks always go down faster than they go up, but they always go up more than they go down. And that's why any chart of any meaningful length of time starts in the lower left and goes to the upper right. And that is because that is how the markets are going to work and the economy is going to work. The macro that would worry me is if I started seeing people not believe in capitalism, or if I started seeing it be impossible to start new businesses. You know, one of the biggest problems in Africa is that in many of the countries in Africa, it is painfully difficult to actually try to start a business, to be an entrepreneur. And if you view things as I do, you view entrepreneurs as providing solutions to their communities and their countries. And they're usually the smartest solutions available, coming from visionary people who are breaking the rules. And if you have basically hampered that or made that impossible, no wonder you're routinely a poor nation, or you have a really hard time getting any international respect, because you've made it hardest for the most valuable people in your society to contribute their brilliant solutions to their countrymen. Mm-hmm. So if I saw that kind of macro turn, Dan, Dave, I would be concerned. And sometimes I am a little bit concerned. We can talk some about that. I'm a conscious capitalist. We can talk some about that. But for the most part, you know, what is unemployment? What is unemployment this quarter? Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's always interesting. It's been actually kind of dramatic what's happened the last two years. But I'm still invested for the next 37 years, and I'm going to be 100% invested. I don't take my money out of the market at different points thinking that I'm smart enough to guess when to get back in. I've never played that game. It's pretty lazy what I'm doing, and I'm not bragging about it. I'm just saying it's so different from what most people do. And so that's why macro matters to me and doesn't really matter to me.
Mm-hmm. Good answer. I'm wondering, like you talked about, you might be concerned if people start questioning capitalism itself. Are you seeing that at all? I mean, we have certain parts of society that seems to, you know, be growing in number that have some disillusionment to capitalism. Combine that with, you know, a very changing political landscape where extremism is getting more into fashion. You have, you know, large government spending that, you know, maybe with the monetary policy theory where, you know, they feel they can spend as much as they want. It sounds like you're still ultimately long-term bullish on the economy, on America, et cetera. But do those things give you kind of like, you know, food for thought at all? Or how are you processing kind of, you know, the changing society in these ways?
Yeah, I recognize that not just in this nation, but all of humanity has been greatly elevated by business over the last few centuries. I mean, the most human measures, if you've read Steven Pinker's work, you know that just looking at the data, our longevity is so much longer than it was just 50 years ago, let alone 500 years ago. Infant mortality rates, so many of the metrics are so positive versus 150 years ago. And you have to recognize that it comes from allowing entrepreneurs to create solutions for their times. And we in this nation, I think, do it better than anybody else in the world. And I sure hope, I feel like my kids know that because they haven't just heard it from me, from the old man. They've actually seen me go out and invest in that and demonstrate that and talk about that. And I think that's really important. I think if we want things to be as good as possible for our kids, we should love what has been created by capitalism. I think we can also hate some of the things that have been created by capitalism. right alongside an amazing company like Apple, to me, is an amazing company, you've got Enron. And often Enron gets the headlines. Enron gets the media attention. And it sometimes seems to people who casually follow this because they're not into it like you and I are, that that's the way business is. It's Enron. But it's not. It's Chick-fil-A. And, you know, it's anything that you open your fridge and enjoy. It's what you're wearing today. It's your favorite shoes. These are all made by your fellow human beings, usually for profit. And it's a beautiful model because you're paying them more than it costs them to provide that. And that gives them capital that they can reinvest and grow. And that is what humanity has just massively benefited from. So I want to make sure everybody knows that and appreciates that. And I'm a conscious capitalist. I recognize that it can be done poorly. It can be done well, like most things. And I think that, and I invest into companies that I believe are conscious about how to do business well and the importance of it for our world. And they're long-term players, not short-term players. And there are four tenets of conscious capitalism, which we don't need to cover today, but anybody can Google conscious capitalism, and you can see and ask yourself, is that stock you're researching right now, is that run by people that are admirable? And is the work of that business improving our world, or is it not? And there are indeed some for-profit companies that I think are net-net subtracting value from the world, just like there are some CEOs who literally, in my mind, subtract value from their company, but that's never shown on the balance sheet or the income statement. A lot of the human dynamics that I look for as a right-brained investor, everybody's left-brained algorithm misses and doesn't see it, and so they end up undervaluing things like corporate culture, innovation, and especially that human dynamic of who the heck is running this thing in the first place. So I think I just gave an answer all over the place, but those are things that are really important to me. I hope that we recognize that the U.S. does business, I would say, better and better. There are more and more conscious companies and more people who recognize that we should do well by our employees and by all of our stakeholders, not just our shareholders. And in fact, the companies, Dave, to end this answer, the companies that treat all of their stakeholders well, their customers, their employees, the environment, their local communities, and their partners and suppliers, and their shareholders usually do best for shareholders, as opposed to just targeting maximizing shareholder value, which is, I think, a lot of the wrong-headed aspects of capitalism. Mm-hmm. Rant over.
Got it. Yeah. No, it's interesting stuff. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I appreciate actually Starbucks. They do, I think, a great job.
Yeah, I just read an article today, Bloomberg, talking about how Starbucks is basically the breeding ground for corporate America. Did you see that story today?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, and I have to admit, like a lot of stories, I kind of read the start of it, but didn't go deep on it because I was already like, I get that. But, you know, Starbucks has been putting its baristas through college in some cases and, you know, can often hire really customer motivated people, fun people. And once they've done their time at Starbucks here for a couple of years, they come to work for the Motley Fool or they come to work for this or that company. And so Bloomberg, anyway, or one writer at Bloomberg was crediting Starbucks for being a breeding ground for good employees for other companies.
Yeah, definitely. I'm curious, when you're looking, evaluating a company, whether to buy it or not, or to recommend it, let's take an example like Shopify or something.
Sure.
How important are the financials? Are you looking at, you know, their quarterly, their annual reports? Are you using some type of evaluation metrics? Are you looking at, you know, price over sales ratio or EBITDA multiple? Or are you looking at future growth rates at all? Are you looking at, you know, like, how important is that quantitative side of the equation for you?
Yeah, so great question and great example. This is a stock that I'm really happy to say we recommended to Motley Fool Rule Breakers to members. I'm seeing it right now, February 24th, 2016. Cost basis $21.02. So it's looking pretty good, up at $1,600 these days, and we've just held all the way through. That's obviously far exceeded our expectations when we first recommended the stock. But we're huge Shopify fans, and I think we all should be Shopify fans. Toby Lukic is a great example of a great CEO. The question is about numbers and how much I pay attention or care about them. Yeah. You know, what I pay most attention to are my frameworks that I've built up based on my own horse sense, evolving it over time. So let's go through the six rule breaker investing traits that I look for in stocks, and let's see which ones are numerical. So the first one is that a company be a top dog and first mover in an important emerging industry. And Dave, I've also often said that's the most important of the six, because if you just confine all of your fishing to that stocked pool, if all of your investing in individual stocks was looking at the top dogs and first movers in important emerging industries, I think you're going to do pretty well. So that one's not numerical. Number two, the second one is we're looking for sustainable competitive advantage. That one is not numerical. Number three, this is where we start getting contrary, where I start liking to break the rules and say things that upset some people. I like to find stocks with strong past price appreciation. If the stock has doubled, a lot of people over the last 6 months, a lot of people say, I missed it. I'm the exact opposite. I'm like, that looks really good to me. And we can talk about why that works. But anyway, that one is numerical, but it's actually about the stock. It's not about the income statement or the balance sheet. The fourth thing that I'm looking for is good management and smart backing. And we've already talked about founders and the importance of human capital. Also, the VCs, like who's actually backing this company, can tell me a lot as well, especially for younger companies. So that one's not numerical. Number five is we're looking for a strong consumer brand. Now, not every company even sells to consumers. So within B2B contexts, I'm looking for why do people buy that one, not that other one. So it still comes down to branding in a sense. But companies that really get branding, like Peloton, that's the kind of company that I really favor as a rule breaker. That's not numerical. And then the final one, and this is the most secret sauce and also most upsetting to a lot of people's mentality. So we're breaking the rules again with number six. I want people to think of that stock and call it actively overvalued. There's a really important dynamic. We could talk about that. But just to answer the question that you gave me in the first place, that's the framework that I use to evaluate which stocks I want to buy. And keep in mind, I'm going to be owning them for years, if not decades. And so I do look at the most recent earnings report. I enjoy looking over balance sheets and seeing a lot of cash and no debt. I love ratios and margins. In fact, I came from a little bit of a baseball background where I was a huge fan of Bill James before Bill James was cool and before Moneyball was written. That's a big thing to me is and Bill James is a total rule breaker himself, what he did for baseball. Anyway, so I love numbers in that way, but I am really very right-brained, I think, as a stock picker. So it's kind of like, do you ever play the card game Bridge? This is possibly a bad example. Many people don't play bridge. I think Buffett plays bridge, by the way. But anyway, all I want to say about bridge is in order to play bridge, you have to learn a lot about the bidding systems. And there's a lot of numbers there and some conventional thing. You have to study it and learn it. And then you go to a tournament, and the way to actually win the tournament is to break the rules that everybody else learned in certain situations. And so that's a great example, again, for me of how to invest. I think it's really important to be able to read financial statements. And I do. I'm not an expert at it. I'm self-taught. I've read some good books, and I've done it over the years. I don't look at everything. I don't go all the way through the 10K. And often the way to beat all the computers with their algorithms and a world that people think you couldn't have an edge. I love your thing earlier about us finding our edge. People do have edges. They should use it. Anyway, is by throwing out some of the numbers or intentionally saying, you know what, we want it to look really overvalued by everybody else's valuation metric. That's actually a buy sign for rule breaker investing.
So. Okay, so this is fantastic. I've been exposed actually to your rule breaking system framework, and there are parts of it that I'm like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic in its angle. What I'm curious is going back to this question though of the quantitative approach. It seems like most of your stuff is not looking at the company's financials, right? Even the quantitative thing of stock price, that's appreciation, you know, in the past. It's not looking at the revenue numbers or the gross margin numbers or, you know, et cetera. I wonder though if that stuff just comes more naturally to you. If this is a hypothesis, maybe tell me if I'm wrong, but sure. You being a generalist interested in so many things, also having a background understanding numbers very well, you're able to parse this stuff very fast. I wonder if one of the criterias in that rule breaking that's not mentioned is number seven, is that this stock has great potential for price appreciation in the coming years. And part of that number seven rule is you're able to look at the business model, the revenue, you know, the margins very quickly and say, this is actually a legitimate business model. You're looking at the growth rate, like good growth rate. You're looking at a lot of this different stuff, and you're saying this has potential, if it works out, to the business model, all the finances could work out to the point where the stock could see a big valuation boost, therefore, you know, that's part of, it seems like, your rule breaking system, is it not?
I think it is, mm-hmm. Dave. I mean, when I give the framework that I did, that is what I want to gift to the world. Mm-hmm. I can't give everything in a single, any framework is going to be limited. There's always going to be a 7th, 8th, 9th, 12th thing I could have included. But I'm assuming that, like a bridge player, you've done your work and you know how to bid. You can read financials. So for me, yeah, as those analysts that I give my new idea out to, they go and do the work and bring it back to me. They're showing me the 5-year numbers for the company. I'm absolutely looking left to right. I'm watching margin growth. I had a bias. It's a good bias, I think, built into me by a dad as a teenager. He's like, you know, I like, David, said my dad, I like companies where you look at the bottom line and it's a 10% or higher net profit margin. Mm-hmm. That means, for those who are not conversant in this, that means that 10 pennies or more on every dollar of sales are profit. So dad installed in me a love of highly profitable enterprises. And you'd think that, gosh, if they're charging 10 pennies on the dollar, why couldn't I just start a business, undercut them at 3 pennies on the dollar and take all their business away? Turns out that doesn't work a lot of the time. In fact, the presence of a high operating margin or a net profit margin shows to me, especially if it's a public company, that they've beaten back their competition. It's a very competitive world out there. People are trying to steal any margin they can anywhere. And Jeff Bezos used to say, your high margin is my opportunity, as I think we've heard of before. So it's a very competitive world out there. Therefore, which are the companies that can maintain 10% or higher net profit margins? The answer is the ones that share the attributes that I just shared with you a little bit ago. Really smart people, great brands, et cetera. So yes, there's a natural parsing of the numbers. But you know, and I, the balance sheet, I mean, things like, I mean, I expect my analysts, and even if my analysts didn't do it, our members would, because we have discussion boards for every stock on our site. So if I missed something, if, for example, accounts payable had gone way up for some reason, or especially accounts receivable, this is a big problem for a lot of growth businesses. They're like, yeah, we got the sale, good, book the sale. You guys can pay us 6 quarters from now, or 6 months from now, or sometimes they don't pay at all, right? And so companies that start to have burgeoning accounts receivable as a percentage of sales, that's a red flag. I'm not incorporating that in my rule breaker framework, but absolutely it's in my mind. It's something that's logical to me, and I can explain to anybody who's in fifth grade probably what accounts receivable are and why you'd want to watch that. So mm-hmm. So a lot of this is fifth grade math for me, and I do it a lot, but I'm not doing higher math, and it's table stakes. It's not why I select a stock.
Got it. I know you're not a big fan of concentration, like huge concentrated positions. You're more, I believe one of your things is 5% max allocation when you start a new position, right, in a company. And over time, that could lead to 20, 40, 60 positions, right? Hopefully not selling the winners, right, ever. A few questions here is, like, I'm curious, were you always like that, like in terms of the 5% rule? Did that come from somewhere else you borrowed? Or is this just something that you're doing out of cautionary? Like, you have so many people following and there's so many people tempted to have quick gains, over, you know, allocate, you know, 20, 30, 40% and lose it all and never want to come back to investing. Is it just wisdom to give this kind of 5% allocation rule? Or is it something that you believe so steadfastly that even if you had no Motley Fool and you were doing your own portfolio, that you would never, ever break this 5% rule, even if you had like this once in a lifetime opportunity in a company?
So the answer is, I think it's a good way to approach investing, and I practice it myself. And What I share with the world, including the stocks that I pick, there a lot of them are in my portfolio, and I'm doing what I'm telling people to do, almost one-to-one. And I want to make it really clear that I am, in a sense, a fan of concentrated positions, because a really key part of my history and what I've taught and talked about is, if you allow winners to run, which is, for a lot of people, hard to do, and for me, maybe the most valuable thing that I've learned, and you need time to show that to you, then you're going to end up with some concentrated positions. And so when I talk about, when you're referencing what I call fair starting line, like if we're starting a new portfolio, we're going to have a minimum of 20 positions and a maximum of 5%, simple math, in any one of those positions. And as soon as that race starts, those percentages start to change. And usually winners win, which is another one of my big watchwords. And so you got to let them win to make a lot of money as a stock market investor. And that might mean you have a huge position in your portfolio. It's not been uncommon for me over the course of my life to have a stock be more than 50% of my whole net worth. So that might sound crazy from the guy who you earlier was saying, you're a 5% guy, Dave, and you like to be diversified, right? I diversify at the start, and then I let history happen, and I want my companies to make history. And the ones that I do, I let them go. And I want to add cautionarily, of course, that this is not for everybody. Mm-hmm. The majority of my net worth is probably tied up in my company stock, The Motley Fool, like a lot of entrepreneurs. And so that's allowed me to be a little bit looser and not too worried about my stock market holdings. And therefore, with that extra license that I gave myself, I've learned the beauty of allowing huge size positions, Netflix, AOL back in the day. These are companies that have gone – I mean, Tesla – our cost on Tesla is $6.29. Mm-hmm. I've had it ever since. It's up 10,222%. So any Rule Breaker member who was with us on November 23rd of 2011, I'm now checking the date, has a cost basis right around mine of $6.29. And I just let it go. Mm-hmm. What do you think that does to allocations if you allow those to go? The answer is it can eat up your whole portfolio. The good news for me anyway, both in my personal portfolio, but more importantly for all of our members, is that we have a lot of such winners. Mm-hmm. And so when you have huge, big-shouldered winners, and it's not just about Tesla, you've also got Netflix, and you've got Amazon for 20 years, et cetera, you end up with more balance. But for a lot of people, Dave, it comes down to what I call the sleep number. Some people use that for mattresses. Mm-hmm. I use it for here's how I use the sleep number, which is one of my rule breaker frameworks. It's what is the percentage you would allow the largest single holding in your portfolio to occupy for that portfolio or your net worth. If it went beyond that, you would lose sleep. What is your sleep number? And because I have learned over 28 years that it's a huge world out there with many different psychologies, viewpoints, et cetera, there's no one number. It's about knowing ourselves, right? And so my sleep number is probably, it's crazy high. It's probably something like 80. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, a lot of funds, it's one. Right? Especially regulated funds. They can't actually hold too much in any one position. But a lot of people, it might be like 10 or 8 or 15. But so for me, I want to make sure everybody understands the context by which I'm saying this. And it's my own unique context. I don't mean it to be yours, but I think everybody should know their own sleep number. So there you go.
Definitely. I mean, there's like, I love talking about some of this stuff with you because you're able to share timeless stories and principles, but yet we could discuss from different angles. So for this, for example, starting Motley Fool, I mean, for example, owning a stock in a company is similar to owning your own company. You're just owning partial ownership of your company. You don't even own probably 100% of the Motley Fool, right? I mean, you share it with your brother. So
you bet. And our employees, every one of them.
Yeah. Okay. So you're a stock owner in Motley Fool, but didn't you put more than 5% of your time and energy and resources and capital into Motley Fool? And weren't you rewarded with an outsized reward for that?
Yeah.
And I mean, that makes sense because you're able to control that. You're able to understand what the business is. You're able to believe in it. You have higher conviction, you know, more authority over the direction. I guess it seems a little bit, I won't say intention, but it seems like I completely agree. The 5% rule makes sense for 99.9% of the people out there. It would just seem like in certain situations, if you can own your own responsibility or your own business, then a concentrated position or in a company that you know you own or something could make sense.
Yeah, I would say that, again, I have an open mind, and almost none of my frameworks or my rules or my breaking of the rules, almost none of those is actually something I think everybody should exactly follow. I'm all about nuance. I'm all about the grays and what makes you and me different because we're all unique and individual. So a lot of the work that I try to do through my podcast and other work is to get people to learn about themselves so that they make the right decisions for themselves. In my experience, the people who run concentrated portfolios successfully are really serious investors, and they're probably professionals. the vast majority of our members, we definitely have some institutional managers and professionals who follow us and seem to buy the stocks that we recommend, but we're really aimed at everybody else.
Yeah.
And for everybody else, the 99.9% that you just referenced, I think a 5% fair starting line approach to a portfolio makes a heck of a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But I'd be the first to say that I'm not doing that myself. I'm the first to say that as by nature of being an entrepreneur, the majority of my wealth is concentrated in one position, and it's a private company.
Exactly. So there's one dynamic here that you mentioned, which is interesting. You have most of your wealth concentrated, let's say, in your own company stock. And it gives you this freedom to just kind of not be too anxious about your portfolio or the ups and downs. And if you have a loser, it's not the end of the world, you know. If a winner occupies more percent, it's not the end of the world. I wonder, I guess it seems like a lot of people might not have that luxury of having this extra asset, and this becomes an extra thing. But I feel like it's such an advantage if you can have that attitude, because you can have a sort of a detachment from the results a little bit, and you can be less anxious, and you can make the big bets when you need to make the big bets. Have you thought about any way, like a normal person who doesn't have this extra, let's say, you know, huge asset to rely on, how they can still take advantage of kind of the things that you are accruing, you know, in terms of being a little more detached, letting your winners ride more easily, et cetera, without like the setup that you have personally?
Yeah. So I try to do that every day, or at least on my podcast every single week. I'm talking about, we're having a conversation like this, and I'm there coaching people basically. And I'm coaching them not in a way that says there's only one answer. Dave, our conversation today has been about how there are many answers. And that might be an eye opener for some people who think it's all about Tesla, hate it or love it. And no, it's just another stock. It's an amazing company. I'm glad we've had a 10-year position in it. And I'm going to keep that for the next 10 years, by the way. But it's not about one company. It's not about one cryptocurrency. It's about your life and probably having some diversity there. So, Dave, to answer the question, when we started The Motley Fool, our stock was worth zero. And I had been investing already for 8 years, as from age 18 to age 26. So I can absolutely get back in the shoes of the vast majority of our members who aren't entrepreneurs and don't have an additional asset. Now, I will say a lot of people do have more assets than just what we're talking about, right? They have real estate.
Sure.
Or they have side hustles. They have other things that do give them a measure of independence from deep concern about their portfolio's performance. But I'm always thinking about the member for whom it is their net worth, their nest egg. And all I can say is that a lot of the coaching and frameworks that I try to give people, I think are useful to people, even if they don't have their side hustle or their additional asset. And I think it's a lot about a mindset, right? And that's maybe what The Motley Fool has done of most value for the world. Mm-hmm. And even people like Morgan Housel, who came out of The Motley Fool having been a writer for us for 8 years or so, he's all about mindset. And I think that's really what foolishness and our philosophy can do for most people, and take them off being the desperate person on Twitter who's always backing their one ticker that they need to hit really big in next week or so, which is the opposite of a foolish capital F investor. And it just sounds stressful to me and more like gambling. And why gamble? The house usually wins. That's why gambling exists.
Yeah, definitely. I had a ton of other questions. I wanted to actually get into different stocks, but I feel like I want to respect your time. And I also want to hopefully, have the opportunity again in the future, maybe a year later or something, to do another deep dive.
I'd love to.
Yeah, because the stuff you're talking about, I think, is so important. I mean, they're like at the crux of investing. And I feel like a lot of times our financial news, it gives a different view. It says, oh, this item, or, this is the most important thing, but we're not hearing the stuff that we're talking about, and people aren't exposed to it enough. What you guys are doing, go to thefool.com, look at, how to invest and the starting guide and all that stuff. You're just repeating that, but it's great introduction. And I love it that we're going deeper into it, because it gives people, I think, more context, to latch onto some of the principles.
Yep. And the greater the island of knowledge, the longer the coastline of mystery. So I'm sure we have even more things to talk about in future. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things we didn't even get into. And yet I still feel like I went maybe arguably too long for the Dave Leon Investing Channel.
No.
Give me the hook anytime, Dave.
Yeah. Next time I'm going to ask for a bit longer. I mean, interviews show a lot to me. And with you and your brother, Tom, you guys have just shown a lot of breadth with investing in depth, a lot of personal connection, and also empathy for the people that you serve. So I just wanted to give a shout out to your team and everything that you guys are doing. I just had a wonderful time chatting. I'm sure everyone else, you know, participating and viewing has had a great time as well.
Well, thank you, Dave. And I will say, because I've done a lot of interviews over the years, you are excellent at what you do. You really put in time to prepare. People probably don't know that, but behind the scenes, Dave has really thought through. I mean, you had a wide variety of topics. We covered a lot of them, and I still went too long. We didn't get to all of them.
Yeah.
But the preparation that you bring to your work is very impressive, and it shows your degree of passion in it. And I thank you for calling out empathy. We don't have enough of it in the world. Mm-hmm. I think kindness is one of America's five core values, and I want us to think about that and remember that. That's why people love Ted Lasso. People love Oprah. People love Mr. Rogers. Because they're incredible examples of kindness in our society, but often that doesn't come through the media reporting, and you hear we're divided and everyone's either pro-Trump or anti-Trump, and it's all, and that just sounds like a mess to me. It's not the world that I'm living in. I'm living in a world of kindness, and we have that at Fool HQ. That's one of the reasons people come to work for us and don't usually leave for long periods of time, because they recognize the power of a culture that they're part of that's based on kindness. It starts with my brother Tom, our CEO, one of the kindest people I know, one of the most big-hearted people that I know. So thank you for that. I think empathy, we need more of it. If it's a stock, I'm buying, and let's keep generating. But thank you for all the great work, Dave Lee, on investing. This is a lot of fun. Let's do it again sometime.
Great. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Talk again soon. Thanks.
Fool on. Okay. Thanks.